Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Today, Donald Trump was back in court, where he is facing 34 felony counts related to the hush money payments he paid to adult film star Stormy Daniels to keep quiet about an alleged affair, and specifically to keep Ms. Daniels quiet in the lead up to the 2016 election. Today, the lawyer that negotiated that hush money agreement for Stormy Daniels, Keith Davidson, took the stand. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. But the big news out of today's trial happened before any witnesses actually testified. Today, the judge in this case, Judge Juan Merchan, ruled on two matters pertaining to Trump himself. One was that Trump will be allowed to attend his very tall son's, Barron's graduation on May 17th, so he can look forward to that. The other matter was also somewhat of a win for Donald Trump. Today, Judge Merchan found Trump in criminal contempt for violating his gag order. The judge ruled that Trump violated the gag order 9 times. As punishment, Judge Merchan fined Trump $9,000, which is $1,000 per violation. And he warned Trump that the court will not tolerate continued willful violations of its lawful orders, and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment. In other words, in plain speak, if Trump continues to violate this gag order, Judge Merchan may throw him in jail. Now, Trump already knew breaking the gag order could result in jail time, but he violated it 9 times anyway. So in many ways, Trump was treated a lot nicer than most Americans in our criminal justice system. And yet, after the trial wrapped for the day, this is what Trump came out and told the press.
They have me sitting here for a Biden trial. It's a Biden trial. I'm sitting here because that's exactly what they want. They don't want me on the campaign trail. This is a corrupt system we're in. And I think the people are understanding it.
That, of course, could not be further from the truth. But what Donald Trump is doing here is projecting. He is describing not the justice system he is actually experiencing, but the justice system if he were in charge of it. And I am not speculating here. This is Trump in an interview with Time magazine published today. Question: would you fire a U.S. attorney who didn't prosecute someone you ordered him to? Trump: it depends on the situation, honestly. Question: so you might? Trump: it would depend on the situation. Yeah. That is from an extensive Time magazine interview that just came out today, and it is chock-a-block with news. Reporter Eric Cortellesa got Trump to actually talk about his plans for a next term if he wins one. And those plans are wow. Like, for example, here's a question from Cortellesa to Trump. You said, "We want to protect police from prosecution." What do you mean by that? Trump: police are being prosecuted all the time, and we want to give them immunity from prosecution if they're doing their job. Now, what Trump is alluding to here is the notion of qualified immunity, which you might remember as a central focus of the Black Lives Matter movement. Qualified immunity is the legal doctrine that allows police officers to avoid personal consequences related to their actions on duty unless those actions violate clearly established law, which is actually a very hard threshold to meet. In practice, that qualified immunity has meant a lot of police officers have killed Black Americans in particular, without consequence. And Donald Trump is all for it, wants more qualified immunity, in fact. When confronted with the fact that violent crime is going down throughout the country, counter to what he has been saying for months and months now, Trump says simply, "I don't believe it." He explains, "The FBI gave fake numbers. It's a lie. It's fake news." So Donald Trump is insisting police have immunity to fight a crime wave that doesn't actually exist. If you are missing the racial subtext here, there is this. Question: polls show a majority of your supporters have expressed the belief that anti-white racism now represents a greater problem in the country than anti-black racism. Do you agree, Trump? Oh, I think that there's a lot to be said about that. I think there is a definite anti-white feeling in this country, and that can't be allowed either. Throughout this interview, Donald Trump also explains his plans if he retakes office. And the most shocking of those plans have to do with immigration and abortion. Question, you've said you're going to do this massive deportation operation. I want to know specifically how you plan to do that. Here's Trump. So if you look back to the 1950s, Dwight Eisenhower was very big on illegal immigration not coming into our country, and he did a massive deportation of people. As a model for his immigration policy, Trump is referring to President Eisenhower's catastrophic deportation of around 1 million Mexican immigrants, known by a code name that happens to be a racial slur, Operation Wetback. It is a dark chapter in American history. The U.S. government used sweeps and brutal military-style tactics to round up Mexican immigrants and ship them out of the country. And from the name to the execution, the whole thing was incredibly racist and brutish and ended up accidentally deporting a ton of people who were actually U.S. citizens. That is the model Donald Trump wants to emulate. Now, Time magazine reporter Eric Cortellesa didn't just let all of that slide. He pressed Trump. He made sure he was correctly understanding exactly what Donald Trump was saying. Here's more. Question, what's your plan, sir? Trump, we will be using local law enforcement. Question, does that include using the U.S. military? Trump, it would. Question, U.S. law says that you can't deploy the U.S. military against civilians. Would you override that? Trump, well, these aren't civilians. These are people that aren't legally in our country. This is an invasion of our country. That is how far Donald Trump would be willing to go to enforce his draconian immigration policies. He would use local cops. He would use the American military. He would break the law because he doesn't consider immigrants to be civilians. And then there are his plans for abortion. Question, your allies in the Republican Study Committee, which makes up about 80% of the GOP caucus, have included the Life at Conception Act in their 2025 budget proposal. The measure would grant full legal rights to embryos. Is that your position as well? Trump, I'm leaving everything up to the states. Question, would you veto that bill? Trump, I don't have to do anything about vetoes because we now have it back in the states. Question, do you think states should monitor women's pregnancies so they can know if they've gotten an abortion after the ban? Trump, I think they might do that. Again, you'll have to speak to the individual states. Question, states will decide if they're comfortable or not prosecuting women for getting abortions after the ban, but are you comfortable with it? Trump, it's irrelevant whether I'm comfortable or not. It's totally irrelevant because the states are going to make those decisions. There have been very few times where Donald Trump has been asked in detail about what he actually plans to do if reelected president. So this is a really rare and an essential piece of journalism here. Trump comes across as both uninformed, but also remarkably cutthroat, willing to embrace extreme, harsh policies and willing to countenance unimagined cruelty. As much as Trump's answers are often garbled or opaque, they are still the clearest, most detailed outline we have had so far, laying out what happens if Donald Trump becomes president once again.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
We're going to speak to the Time reporter who interviewed Donald Trump in just a moment. But first, we are going to go back to our breaking news, that developing situation at Columbia University. Joining me now is MSNBC correspondent Antonia Hilton, who's outside Columbia. Antonia, I know that this is a quickly moving front here. What can you tell us about the situation at Columbia right now?
So, Alex, right behind me here, that is Hamilton Hall. Officers in riot gear are now lining up in front of the gate that is providing the closest access to that building, where approximately 60 people, including students and potentially, according to the NYPD, maybe outside actors and anarchists, are inside, barricaded in. And there was, moments ago, a massive group of protesters right there on the street, chanting to the people inside, showing them support. And the police came up to them and told them very clearly that they had to disperse or risk arrest. So all of those people have fanned out on either side of the gate now, and they're chanting at the police. There are people shouting from windows at the police. It is extremely tense here. I'm going to step back so you can actually see some of the scene yourself. So you can see those officers in riot gear prepping to get close to that gate. There's been an open question all night, Alex, of how are they actually going to enter? How are they going to approach Hamilton Hall? We saw officers in riot gear on Broadway closer to 114th Street, and they had multiple entry points to consider. It looks now, though, like a critical mass has chosen this gate here on Amsterdam and 116th Street. Really, the fear for students and go ahead.
Just to give a little context to what we're seeing here, the occupation of Hamilton Hall, can you give us a little of a timeline in terms of when it began? And do we have any more of a clearer picture about who is in there?
So this all began last night at about 12:30 a.m. Protesters moved toward Hamilton Hall. They brought supplies and gear. They entered, smashed windows, used furniture and gates and all kinds of items like trash cans to barricade all the entrances to that building. At points, they even had scuffles with students who tried to block some of the entrances to Hamilton Hall. Students described hearing chaotic sounds, chanting, singing, and things breaking all through the night. And many of them, even pro-Palestinian students who have been supportive of the encampment, supportive of students having their voices here, were at times a little bit shaken by this and concerned that this was an escalation that would lead to essentially what we're seeing here now. I haven't really met students who are excited by the prospect of the NYPD returning here. And students on all sides, actually students and faculty on all sides of this issue, they are angry, frankly, with the administration. There's a feeling for many Jewish students that the administration has really not done enough about their concerns, the threats and harassment and fear that they've felt on campus, and that at many points she set these arbitrary deadlines and said that she was going to do something and then let those deadlines disappear. So they're angry on that side. On the pro-Palestinian side, they're frustrated with the administration because of what happened on April 18th when we saw the NYPD enter the first time. 100-plus students get arrested, disruptions to classes. Many students describe feeling traumatized, no matter what they believed politically, by just the sight of what happened to their classmates that day. And so what they think is about to happen here right now is extremely upsetting to them. There's also been a message that's gone out to faculty and to students, telling everyone that they need to shelter in place because of police activity. That, too, is extremely unsettling. It has students wondering if they're caught out in the yard or nearby Hamilton Hall. I mean, it's right next to residential spaces. What will happen to them if they're misinterpreted as being part of the protest or simply get in the way of what the NYPD has to do in order to get 60 people out of this building? Our understanding is that there are some students who are part of the movement, but this has always been a decentralized thing. There's never been one leader, one very clear group that is making a decision about this action or that. So there are a couple dozen people in there, but they could be a mix of students and then outside actors. who, according to the NYPD, may be trained for this kind of thing, which raises the specter, the fear of violence and a very concerning kind of confrontation to a whole new level, Alex.
Yeah, and we have some news. NBC can report that Columbia University has sent a letter to the city of New York asking for assistance. That is coming from NBC News. Antonia, in terms of Mayor Adams and his position on all of this, he's been quite vocal. We also know that, you know, as you talk about the unrest among the students, the faculty has also been quite engaged on this. I believe earlier today, the faculty sent a letter. Now, this is prior to the situation we're seeing unfolding right now, but a letter saying the NYPD presence in our neighborhood endangers our entire community. They hold the university leadership responsible for what they call disastrous lapses of judgment that have gotten us to this point. The university president, her senior staff, and the board of trustees will bear responsibility for any injuries that may occur during any police action on our campus. Now, it's almost like they're telegraphing what we see unfolding right here, which is a very tense situation, hopefully, that does not escalate from here. But Antonia, can you give me a sense of what you're, I mean, you're right there with the NYPD. What can you tell us about where the mayor has been on this thus far and the police presence that you're seeing at this particular moment?
The mayor and NYPD have been pretty clear all along that while they respect students' right to protest, that they sensed that if things got to a point that was violent, that they would be ready again to re-enter campus. They've consistently offered their help to the university. For a while, though, there have been these ongoing negotiations with faculty, staff, and administrators all coming to a table and trying to figure out a way to de-escalate this, to avoid exactly what's happening behind me here. Clearly, those talks have failed. But when you look at the examples of what's happening all around the country right now, you see one extreme, which are schools that have had the police return day after day to interact with protesters. I'm receiving a note. Police are officially on campus. Police are officially on Columbia's campus, Alex. The other end of that extreme would be what happened at Brown, where instead of what is about to happen here at Brown, the students have taken down their encampment and the university board has agreed to vote on the possibility of divestment. And so these are the two options that could have been on the table. It's clear the side that Columbia's administration chose tonight.
It's Antonia, on that end, it's hard to get a sense of where exactly the negotiations fell apart. I mean, we had the editor-in-chief of the Columbia Spectator on last week when the situation was, you know, the tension was already there. And there were ultimatums being given by the faculty or by the president's office that didn't seem to be followed through on as a negotiating tactic. I'm not sure that's the most effective. But do you know, I mean, beyond the divestment, are there other sticking points that haven't been resolved? Meaningfully and materially, I wonder what the focus point of the negotiations has been.
Well, the focal point is the question of divestment and whether the university would even consider bringing that to a vote. The student body at Columbia and Barnard, they have repeatedly voted on the question of divestment to show the university their perspective. And the numbers in support have been very high. I mean, north of 70 and 80%. Okay, we see additional NYPD and riot gear about to enter. It looks like this is about to happen any moment now. What I can tell you is from the student perspective, the talks fell apart the moment that the university made clear that they would once again invite the NYPD, or even at one point, they say, threaten to bring the National Guard in. That created immense fear, concerns that students at Columbia would be subjected to what happened at Kent State, which led to deaths, students dying. That is the concern here tonight. And I think that's why you see in the language from the faculty members that you mentioned that they are trying to signal in advance of whatever happens that they will put the blame at Manoush Shafiq's feet. That is the president of Columbia. And I can tell you, again, from the conversations I've had with every kind of community member here, everything is consistently coming back to a feeling that the administration has not been clear in their messaging, has not shown a willingness to work, not just with the students, but I've been receiving messages from faculty all throughout the day who say that they reached out to the administration today and said, hey, can we help you at the table? Can we talk to some of the students for you? Can we figure out a way to de-escalate this? And the quote that I got back was, we have been shut out. And so they're trying to telegraph to her that if somebody gets hurt, if a student of ours gets hurt tonight, we are going to point the finger at you tomorrow morning.
You know, it's probably worth mentioning here, again, if you're following along with us, it's a very, very tense situation up at Columbia University. This is all related to the war in Gaza, pro-Palestinian encampment that Columbia has wanted to see come down. Students apparently running straight into a roadblock as far as negotiations on divestment with Columbia leadership. You know, it is worth noting that this Columbia protest has spawned a movement that has really flowered at campuses across the country. They have had, as you point out, Antonia, different outcomes at other schools. This is by far the most pitched confrontation we've seen thus far. But I do wonder, you know, as we talk about the police presence and the students who've barricaded, or the actors, the people, whoever they are, who have barricaded themselves in Hamilton Hall, what is the campus like, Antonia? School is out soon, and Columbia, if I'm not mistaken, switch to virtual classes at least a week or two ago in order to sort of de-escalate the situation, if you will. Is there a large student presence on campus independent of what's happening here?
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of students on campus. There are a lot of students around me now watching, waiting to see what happens to their classmates, potentially. Some of them are moving down to other blocks. Some of them are planning to stay here to see what happens at this gate. But they are very present on the ground. We have an NBC News intern who is a student who has sent us video and information about what's happening inside. So there are kids in their dorms who will watch what happens from the window. So classes have been a virtual hybrid option. They went 100% virtual today because people simply couldn't get access. Okay, massive NYPD trucks coming down the street. Students have been nervous about this the entire day. And I can tell you, the 2 p.m. deadline, it became very clear yesterday after this 2 p.m. deadline that was set, the university saying, please voluntarily pack up this encampment, please leave. And if you do that, we will make sure you graduate or end the semester in good standing. The second that went by and it became clear the encampment was going nowhere, we were here until almost 9 o'clock last night. You could feel in the air, in interactions with faculty and staff and students, that something was going to happen, whether that was going to be the NYPD or the students escalating this themselves. And now it's become very clear. The students changed their strategy. They moved into Hamilton Hall. They're clearly trying to create echoes to 1968 and the anti-Vietnam War, anti-war protests. And now the NYPD is here. And so in many ways, this is the absolute worst case scenario for pretty much everyone involved. I'm going to step to the side so you can take a look at what's coming by here.
Yeah, and Antonia, it goes without saying that we please stay safe in all of this. Your reporting is essential and vital, but you're precious to our network. So please, if you need to move to a different area, by all means do so, because it clearly seems like the situation is escalating. You know, you talk about the echoes of 1968, Antonia, and you know, it's impossible to talk about this moment without the political overlay here. Obviously, the war in Gaza has become a major concern for this White House, this Democrat, Joe Biden, who is running for re-election. Republicans have seen, I believe, what they think is an opportunity to lay this at the president's feet, at Democrats' feet. Go ahead.
All right. Alex, I got to tell you what's happening over here. There is a crane that is now getting placed onto a structure adjacent to Hamilton Hall, and it looks like officers are planning to walk across that and essentially enter on a sort of partial section of roof. I'm not, Art, are you able to swing to see that?
We can see the crane. I guess the question is,
okay,
the main entrance to Hamilton Hall, I would assume, is barricaded. And so they're trying to take an alternate route into the building.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
That would be windows. Exactly.
And just again, let's reset.
They would be able to access that through the windows on the side there.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
Yeah, let's reset for anybody that's joining us right now. There is a standoff between protesters who've barricaded themselves in the Columbia University's historic Hamilton Hall. And we think there are about 60 in number. It's unclear if they are all students or whether there are outside agitators. Police, the NYPD, are on the site. Columbia University has requested assistance from New York City. Mayor Adams has provided that. You'll see these giant police trucks and now a crane that, Antonia, maybe you can give us a little bit more detail here. The police officers, I think, are on top of the truck and ready to walk across the crane.
That's right.
To enter Hamilton Hall.
This crane has a sort of ramp-like structure at its top. So what they're going to do is rest it right on this sort of section that connects but also separates Hamilton Hall from one of the residential halls next door. So they can rest the crane there. The idea would be the officers walk across that and presumably access windows. There are students in that building, though, right to the left of Hamilton Hall, who will be able to see exactly what's transpiring just feet away from them. In addition to the officers, it looks like more than a dozen of them on the top of that crane there who are approaching right now, that there are hundreds of other officers right here on the street in riot gear. We also know that they already entered campus from another point, which means that whoever's in Hamilton Hall is not just going to see the NYPD enter here, but they're also going to presumably try to access other doors, windows, whatever they might be, at another location, another corner of this building.
Now, we know that
this is a massive response.
Yeah, it absolutely looks that way from what we're seeing on TV right now. We know that students have been told to shelter in place, and we're told that, I believe, earlier today, if I'm not incorrect about that. But it doesn't sound
That's
like
right.
students. It sounds like there's still a large student presence in and around this.
Students have been told to shelter in place. That only came out about an hour ago. Some of the students tell me, though, that because of the barricades that have been set up all over the place. Okay, we see an officer approaching a window right now. You can hear people screaming, shame on you, boo. Students are all around us. They want to watch. There are also neighbors, people who live in this community here, who want to witness what happens right now. So it's very clear people have chosen not to shelter in place. There are students inside their dorms, but there are a lot of people out here on the street waiting to see what happens any moment now, Alex.
And I'm assuming it's hard to make out the shot a little bit, Antonia, but they're in full riot gear, yes?
Full riot gear. One of the officers has a shield in his arm. They have flashlights, and it looks like they're trying to find a way to break into that window that goes right into Hamilton Hall. All day long, you could get glimpses of the people who were barricaded inside. Occasionally, they would pull up a shade, unfurl a new banner that said something like Free Palestine. One even went up to the roof at one point to wave a flag for a while. And the NYPD had drone operators here who flew drones overhead to sort of monitor for quite a while before this all began. But now they're clearly trying to make an entrance through that window right there at the corner of 116th and Amsterdam.
Just for context, encampments at the University of Connecticut, Yale, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill were cleared out. About four dozen encampments on college campuses remain across the country, but the one where the situation is clearly the most tense and has escalated to the highest degree is here in New York City at Columbia University, uptown in Manhattan. Antonia, I don't know if you can make this out, but are they trying to speak with the protesters who've locked themselves inside? Is that what's happening?
We certainly can't hear the officers who are right by that window, but it does not look like there is dialogue. I can't actually see another person on the other end of the window, but that's because there is a shade that has been blocking any visibility into the building all day. So that's some of the instability, the concern here is one thing we do know that happened when they entered last night around 12:30 a.m. is that the first thing protesters did was wrap trash bags around security cameras. And so they may be walking into an unknown whenever the officers open that window or breach one of the doors. Okay, we hear some noises. It sounds like they're oh, an officer is going through the window. The first officer has entered the window. People are screaming on the street in response. Okay, here they go.
So what we're witnessing is NYPD officers in full riot gear entering Hamilton Hall on Columbia University's campus in New York City. There are a group of about 60 people inside that building. It's unclear if they're all students, whether there are outside groups or agitators that have installed themselves in the building. The echoes of 1968 are undeniable, especially in this moment. You see just an enormous police presence. That's a crane that they're walking up to get into the building as the main entrance has been barricaded. Antonia, what is the reaction? We can hear some of it, but what's going on in the crowd right now?
There are hundreds of people chanting "Shame on you." As I said, Alex, this is their worst nightmare, and that's for people on many sides of this issue. Even for students who are upset with the classmates who escalated it to this point, who don't condone what's happened in Hamilton Hall, this is not what they wanted to have happen. There were high hopes around the negotiations at first. People were very excited about certain faculty members who they felt had good rapport with the administration and trust from the students. And they thought there might be a possibility of dialogue, of a vote of the kind that's happening at Brown University. And so for anyone who's joining us now, you know, there's been a range of response at universities to this. We have seen consistent police presence in places, in universities in places like Texas. We have seen what happened here at Columbia, where there was an entrance of the NYPD, about 100 plus arrests back on April 18th. But then a lot of silence and an encampment that was largely peaceful for days and days and days. Then at Brown University, they closed their encampment down. And that is because the protesters were able to come to an agreement with the university to take it to a vote so that the board of governors, essentially, of Brown could consider the students' concerns and questions and then take action themselves. And the students felt like that was a good enough middle point that it made them feel like their voices had been heard. And so the question for many people has been, why couldn't something like this happen here at Columbia? And it's because the negotiations, the conversations seem to have failed.
Antonia, we're gonna go to Tom Winter now, but please stand by. Obviously, this is a kinetic situation. Joining me now on the phone is NBC News Tom Winter, who's been in touch with police as we're watching this unfold live on air. Tom, what can you tell us about how the police are approaching this situation and any directives or requests they've gotten from Columbia University?
Yeah, so as NBC News was first to report about half an hour ago, Columbia University transmitted a letter to the city of New York authorizing the New York City Police Department and the city to enter its premises to make any sort of arrest that they deem appropriate or assist them in any way. Columbia University is obviously private property in the city of New York, so the NYPD just can't go on there for, you know, whatever reason. Just because they feel like it. They either needs to be a crime in progress or a complaint, or they need to be asked on for the I want to point out a couple of things you've been looking at. If you're looking at a red flashing light on some of these officers, that's a body-worn camera. You've got a number of different types of police officers that are going in on this specialty vehicle that the NYPD has. Primarily, the initial officers that entered are part of the NYPD's emergency services unit. So there's a saying that when the rest of us need help, we call police. When the police need help, they call emergency services unit. And so the officers that initially went in are part of ESU. The officers that are going in now, you've seen some with cameras. They're there to document the arrest, to document evidence, what they've seen inside. And they obviously have the flexi cuffs. They have the bulletproof vests and the ballistic helmets as well. So their job is to go in there. The students there are likely going to face, at a minimum, trespassing charges, burglary charges, potentially vandalism charges. And it's what's happening inside that hall, Alex, that has law enforcement so concerned. Primarily, they're concerned that there's a group of anarchist-type individuals who have no particular ideology. It's pro-Palestine today, pro-Israel tomorrow, pro-another cause next week. But their main goal, police say, is to try to find a way to engage in a violent way to fight police. And that's what has police so concerned, because they're worried about the students that these individuals have co-opted. That's their belief. And they're worried that they could get hurt. And they're certainly worried about the lives of their officers. So that's really the concern. That was the reason why you had the press conference earlier today. And that's why you've seen such an escalation over the last 8 to 12 hours in police's concern about what's going on at Columbia University. So that's why you're seeing the response tonight.
Tom, do they have any evidence that there are anarchists involved here, or is that just kind of a general concern? I'm looking at the police entering the hall from the window of Hamilton Hall from a ladder truck. It is a number of officers, and I'm just wondering, you know, whether they've given any sort of intelligence on how and why they believe there might be outside groups involved in this.
Sure. So I spoke to the head of NYPD's Intelligence and Counterterrorism Program, Deputy Commissioner Rebecca Weiner, earlier tonight. She also was part of the press conference. They say they've uncovered evidence, and they've produced video and evidence that they've recovered through security cameras, through social media posts online from inside that hall. And they say they've identified a number of individuals that that are well known to the NYPD over a number of years that they believe are definitely inside of there. They don't know the totality of the individuals that are inside of there, but they say they have hard evidence that these people are there. Time will tell. We'll see who's arrested. We'll see what comes out of there. We'll see what images we see. We'll always report. And, you know, our job, and the NYPD understands this, is to we never take anybody's word at face value. But knowing the people and the type of investigators involved, they do have a really good handle on these groups. And so they absolutely believe this is not a theory. They say they have hard evidence that that's the case. And that's why they're so concerned about this hall. And that's why they were so concerned about the developments there today.
All right. Well, they are certainly responding based on that intelligence right now. NBC News investigative reporter Tom Winter. Tom, thanks so much for the breaking news and information. I want to go now to Michelle Goldberg, opinion columnist for The New York Times. Michelle, thank you for being here. I know you're covering this. Did you spend some time at Columbia?
Yeah, I was at Columbia for most of the day today.
And can you tell, like, this has been brewing for a number of days. What was the sense that you got on campus?
Well, it's actually very, very quiet today because they had completely locked down the campus. Mm-hmm. I was lucky that somebody from the journalism school helped me get in. But otherwise, the press doesn't have that much access. I mean, it's really the student journalists that are doing a heroic job letting the world know what's going on Columbia's campus. But, you know, clearly it's an untenable situation. And both sides, you said that negotiations had completely broken down. As for the idea that there are kind of outside agitators, I think this is something that we hear all the time. And so I'm not saying I have evidence one way or the other, but I think we should take it with a few grains of salt. I saw one video that the NYPD released that showed, you know, kind of in the crowd that was surging towards Hamilton Hall, there was, you know, they pointed out one older looking woman who I guess is
known to them.
But I think that, you know, we have seen very little in the way of hard evidence. And I would assume that most of the people in Hamilton Hall are students.
Right, and it's not an overstatement to say that this is an issue that has really animated a lot of students on a lot of campuses across the country, right? This is unfolding across America as it is. I mean, the epicenter is here in New York City at Columbia, but certainly it's an issue that has really ignited a lot of passions across the country. I do wonder, though, you know, when we talk about the way in which the administration has handled this, which is something that everybody points to as problematic, which is, and by everyone, I mean students and faculty alike. Mm-hmm. The president of Columbia, Manoush Shafiq, went to Congress and testified on the Hill and had, I think, a demonstrably, shall we say, deferential attitude towards some of the line of questioning. She did not push back on allegations that this was an inherently anti-Semitic exercise, this encampment. I think to the chagrin of not just pro-Palestinian groups on campus, but some other students as well. And I wonder, you know, if you could, if, you know, being a reporter, if you can contextualize that moment through to where we are today.
Sure. I mean, I think the encampment started before her testimony. So her testimony wasn't responsible for the encampment, but I think what I've heard from people is that her testimony threw fire on a volatile situation by just making it so clear that the administration had, you know, kind of no sympathy for the demands of protesters, for, you know, the fact that the administration threw several members of their faculty under the bus, revealed what should have been confidential disciplinary proceedings, sometimes disciplinary complaints that were unknown to the professors themselves. And I also think that in retrospect, this makes, you know, a lot of people were really appalled by the performance of Claudine Gay and is it Catherine McGill, but the presidents of Harvard, Penn,
yes,
and MIT. But this is exactly what they were trying to avoid when they refused to commit to saying that, you know, the chant "From the river to the sea" is genocidal, that it violates their school's policies. They didn't want to commit to cracking down on student protesters. And I think that that decision looks pretty smart in retrospect.
I want to read a statement that we just got from Columbia. A little after 9 p.m. this evening, the NYPD arrived on campus at the university's request. This decision was made to restore safety and order to our community. We regret that protesters have chosen to escalate the situation through their actions. After the university learned overnight that Hamilton Hall had been occupied, vandalized, and blockaded, we were left with no choice. Columbia public safety personnel were forced out of the building, and a member of our facilities team was threatened. We will not risk the safety of our community or the potential for further escalation. The leadership team, including the Board of Trustees, met throughout the night and into the early morning, consulting with security experts and law enforcement to determine the best plan to protect our students and the entire Columbia University community. We made the decision early in the morning that this was a law enforcement matter and that the NYPD were best positioned to determine and execute an appropriate response. This is interesting. We believe that the group that broke into and occupied the building is led by individuals who are not affiliated with the university. Sadly, this dangerous decision followed more than a week of what had been productive discussions with representatives of the West Lawn encampment. It goes on to talk about the security precautions that they're taking on campus. And they are making clear that the life of campus cannot be endlessly interrupted by protesters who violate the rules and the law.
I mean, look, I do think that once they broke into the hall, once they kind of seized this building, the administration was in a no-win situation because no administration is kind of going to tolerate their buildings being taken over indefinitely. Mm-hmm. That said, this is less than 24 hours. So they clearly decided to move extremely quickly. And we'll find out soon enough, I guess, whether this was indeed, quote unquote, outside agitators. But now you have not just the NYPD, but Columbia's administration putting their credibility on the line.
I do. You know, I got to say, when we talk about this, it's become the issue that's unfolding here has become actually much bigger in a lot of ways than the war in Gaza. It has become, I mean, with the entrance of the Speaker of the House, Republicans who are talking about the situation, Mike Johnson, who was there last week, it's become sort of the embodiment of the left-right divide in higher education.
Well, and I think there's something kind of tragic about this, that, you know, Netanyahu in Israel is threatening to invade Rafah, right? And in a way, these protests against the war have eclipsed the war that they're,
yes,
protesting. And that might be partly the fault, frankly, of us in the media. I think it's also maybe the kind of lack of strategy of some of these demonstrators that have made the protests, you know, some of the demands of the protesters are now about the protests, right? They're demanding amnesty. There was a press conference today where they were asking for food and water for the protests. Gaza itself, we've kind of all lost sight of it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually not talking about that. We're talking about what happens when, you know, a student protest reaches a certain, or an outside protest, whatever it is, reaches a certain point that the university can no longer tolerate. What we were just seeing was protesters being detained. I believe people who had been taken out of Hamilton Hall. Yes, people who had been taken out of the hall and are now being put in police custody. Michelle, hang here for a second. I just want to bring in MSNBC law enforcement analyst and former member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, Cedric Alexander, who's also been in touch with the New York Police Department and sources there this evening. Cedric, what can you tell us about, you know, how your understanding of this situation and the hope for sort of resolution in the least violent way possible?
Well, I think we're going to see resolution throughout the course of the evening. It's going to be very planful. It's going to be very methodical. And I'm quite sure that NYPD has had some time to prepare for this in case they were called in, and they have been called in. So I think what you're seeing evolving right in front of you is a police department, certainly that historically have had years of experience in working in these types of situations. And I think what you're seeing tonight is a demonstration of them being very organized, very prepared, under good supervision, supported by the mayor and the city at large. And I think that at the end of this, hopefully it will go throughout the night without any real incident. So I'm very hopeful of that. But I'm quite sure all this has been planned out throughout the course of the last few days. And now that NYPD has been given permission to come in, that is what we're seeing. And they appear to be doing this job very well. But that does not mean you will not have those who may resist. If they do, I'm quite sure that they will use the force that would be appropriate and proportional to the resistance. But let's just hope for the best. And I think we'll get through this night, because this certainly needs to come to an end. And I think we're all in agreement of that.
We know that police were entering with zip ties. We have no reason to believe that anybody inside Hamilton Hall is armed, however. Is that right?
Well, we have no reason to believe that. But however, I think in any kind of circumstance, you certainly want to go in being prepared for whatever may be on the other side of that door inside that building. But I don't think that's so much of a concern. They are trained for these type of incidents. You're seeing a well-trained uniformed force that is entering both from the ground and upstairs. And I think they'll be well prepared for whatever is on the other side. And here again, we all are going to be hopeful that this will go without any incident throughout tonight.
MSNBC law enforcement analyst Cedric Alexander, thank you so much for your time tonight. Really appreciate it. I want to bring in Marianne Hirsch, who is a professor at Columbia University. Professor Hirsch, I'd just love to get your thoughts about what we're seeing unfolding here, which is probably the sort of worst case scenario of how, I mean, short of a worst case scenario, but up there in terms of how a protest meets its resolution. What can you tell us about what you've seen and what you've heard during your time on campus?
Well, I think this is utterly tragic. It did not have to be this way. I think the university and the administration have escalated this situation from the very beginning by bringing in police already on April 18th, arresting students. That makes the protests grow. There have been deadlines and other deadlines. I think all of the protest has been criminalized rather than being treated as a right of students to express their opinions. And this takeover of Hamilton Hall last night also does not have to resolve in this police takeover tonight. As far as I know, there have been no serious negotiations. There hasn't been professional mediation. There hasn't been enough time to resolve the situation in a different way.
When you talk about the police presence being a galvanizing force, can you speak more to that? I mean, the way in which the escalation here has actually brought students into the fold, if you will, or brought them into the issue or engaged them in some way.
Well, President Shafiq testified before Congress. There was an encampment on campus within really literally a day. Police was called to campus to eliminate the encampment and arrest students. This was very fast. I've never heard of anything happening so fast. And that's galvanized the movement across the country and now across the world. There have been encampments everywhere. I'm not sure why this has to be resolved with violence so quickly. Why haven't there been more discussions and conversations and professional mediation? And also, visits by the administration to the encampments, discussions with the students about their demands and about their political convictions.
Marianne Hirsch, a professor of English at Columbia University. Professor, if you could just stay with me for a few more minutes. I want to bring in by phone now Jelani Cobb, who is, of course, the dean of the Columbia University School of Journalism. Dean, we spoke about this when it was first beginning, and I just wonder what your thoughts are tonight as we watch this heavy, heavy New York City police presence enter Hamilton Hall.
Well, it's tragic. You know, I think, you know, the probably one of the few things that people would agree in about in this very contentious situation is that it's a very difficult thing to see, you know, the NYPD, you know, on campus. I do want to make a couple of corrections, however. There have been extensive negotiations. I'm aware of that because I've been part of them. And those negotiations have gone on for 8 days straight. And there actually has been professional remediation. There've been people from Columbia Law School who've been involved in it, and from the Faculty Senate and an array of other voices. Those negotiations proved to have met an impasse that seems to have not been surmountable. But the idea that there was no engagement with the students across that time is not true. And, you know, given everything that I've done in my career and the things that I've written about and my long history of writing about police brutality and concern about the police use of force, my motivation, and I think the motivation for the people who were in the negotiating team, was to try to forestall something like this happening. And I will say, there'll be plenty of time to evaluate, you know, the decision making here. But in terms of a window into the understanding, I got calls from people at high up in state government and people who were highly placed in municipal government asking the same thing. Could they guarantee that the people who were occupying the building were Columbia students, or the people who were in the encampment were Columbia students? And there was no way to verify that. And there was a great deal of concern that while, you know, Columbia, the recognition that members of the Columbia community you know, may have had a kind of range of behavior that you could anticipate. There was a lot of concern about what people from outside the community may have been capable of. And so that was something that was, you know, consistent worry from people in all sorts of different areas.
It's really hard to imagine that this issue is in any way settled after what we're seeing unfold tonight. And I kind of wonder, Jelani, Professor Dean, what you expect sort of tomorrow to look like. That we have word that there are dozens who've been taken into police custody. The focus here has been Hamilton Hall. But for the issue writ large, the encampments and the general student dissatisfaction with Columbia and its resistance to divesting, I just wonder what you imagine comes next.
No clue. And I don't think anyone has a sense of that. You know, I don't think we anticipated this, you know, 2 weeks ago. So, you know, the one thing that we probably, again, one of the few things that we would agree on is that this is not resolved and that we'll have more you know, issues along these lines to contend with. So, yeah.
I just want to reset for anybody joining us at this late hour. We're closely following developments out of Columbia University. In the last hour, students were ordered to shelter in place due to police activity. That activity was a massive response by New York City police. At the top of the hour, NYPD officers in full riot gear entered the campus and began making arrests. It is still unclear at this moment how many students have been arrested. But what we do know is that before police entered the campus, an NYPD official said protesters who have barricaded themselves in a university building that's known as Hamilton Hall, that those protesters will be charged with third-degree burglary, criminal mischief, and trespassing. Now, moments ago, we saw dozens of officers make their way into the occupied building, Hamilton Hall, from the back. Police also said those in the encampments on the West Campus, I believe, could be charged with trespassing and disorderly conduct. NBC News was first to report that Columbia University asked the NYPD to enter and make lawful arrests. Just moments ago, Columbia released a statement noting that the decision to reach out to the NYPD was in response to the actions of the protesters, not the cause they are championing. We have made it clear that the life of campus cannot be endlessly interrupted by protesters who violate the rules of law. Michelle, you know, you point this out, and we should continue to point it out, that we're talking about a situation between law enforcement and campus protesters, we'll call them for now, but we are not talking about the issue at hand, which is the deathly war in Gaza, where over 35,000 people have been killed, a potentially looming invasion of Rafah, an Israeli prime minister who even President Trump had harsh words for.
Yeah, an Israeli prime minister who seems to be doing his best to kind of scuttle any hope of a ceasefire in the hope of saving his far-right coalition and keeping himself out of prison. And again, I think that this is a failure of the media. It's a failure of us. But it is, I mean, these protests have clearly turned, these protests that were meant to awaken the world's conscience to what's happening in Gaza, to make it seem that business as usual can't continue as long as this war goes on. They've clearly had some impact, but they've also, through their, I think, some of their own tactics, have made the story about them.
Well, and I would say there has, you know, we started to talk about this. It has been a political opportunity, especially for members of the far right, to make this a plank in the war on woke, right? The idea that this is liberal elites flouting the law, effectively showing a middle finger to leadership and doing what they want, occupying halls. And that needs to be met with the strong arm of law and order is something that is ripe for Republicans, which is why you saw the Speaker of the House visiting Columbia not that long ago. This is something they like to talk about, not in the context of what the policy on Israel should be, but in the broader context of how elites are you know, against order and rule of law, and that, you know, the sort of bastions of elite institutions need to be brought back to reality.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that this is exactly the kind of outcome that Elise Stefanik and other members of that committee wanted when they, you know, hauled the presidents of various schools before them and demanded a firmer response. And, you know, I think this, there's a reason why just today they've called three more college presidents in for a hearing next month. Right? This is catnip to them.
I want to go back to Marianne Hirsch, who is, of course, a professor of English at Columbia University. Professor, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, you know, in the as a nod to what this is actually about, what you've been hearing from your students as the war has progressed, and beyond the sort of divestments issue, which we know is a sticking point, a major sticking point in these negotiations, what more they wanted to see from Columbia leadership?
Well, divestment is one, but I think they want, I think that they're very serious about the issue of divestment, which has to do with watching this incredible violence across the world and knowing that the United States and their own university is somehow implicated in it. We have not really, I know there have been negotiations. Jelani Kapp told us there have been. I think my misunderstanding of that is a symptom of the lack of communication on campus. And students have a variety of opinions. I think one thing that we all as faculty and also students came together on is that we did not want police presence on our campus. We have procedures for dealing with infractions. We have a university senate. None of those structures have been used properly by our administration, and that's been there's been a tremendous lack of trust and lack of communication among us. I want to respond for a second to Michelle Goldberg's statement that this is taking a lot of attention away from the war in Gaza. I think you could say that, but I also think that there's been a tremendous gratitude from the people of Gaza for the engagement of students on American campuses and on campuses across the world. This has brought attention, and it's a gesture of solidarity that I think is being appreciated. I also feel that if we can't negotiate our way out of this situation, how can we expect the Middle East crisis to be resolved? This is a much more simple issue to negotiate than a ceasefire in Gaza.
Marianne Hirsch, professor of English at Columbia University, thank you for your time and insight into this. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michelle, the Hamilton Hall is it, for people who are not familiar with the Columbia campus, in April of 1968, 56 years ago, hundreds of students seized the building during protest over the Vietnam War. I do not think that was lost to the people who stormed Hamilton Hall. After a week, this is again in 1968, police entered through underground tunnels and cleared them out. Over 700 people were arrested.
Right. And that's remembered as a really dark chapter in Columbia's history, which is why it's so breathtaking to see them repeat it.
But it does, you know, putting this in the broader context of what's happening in American politics. I mean, when this began, I think for a lot of people, all of these campus protests had the echo of the 1960s. It feels like an inflection point for the country. We're barreling towards a presidential election. The country feels catastrophically divided on every issue, based from basic facts to, you know, an actual policy vision.
We're having a Democratic presidential convention in Chicago.
Yes, well, exactly. Echoes of 1968. And I just wonder, you know, it's hard to imagine that this is... This imagery of the NYPD storming Columbia in this moment is not going to reverberate in ways that we cannot yet see across the political divide.
Well, and I think that we should remember what the kind of images of protest disorder did in the late 60s. Yeah. Because even as the Vietnam War became increasingly unpopular, so did the anti-war protests. And it was in part the backlash to that, as well as to urban crime, that gave us not just Richard Nixon, but, you know, kind of except for the four-year oasis of Jimmy Carter, kind of unbroken Republican rule until Bill Clinton. You know, and so I would expect that, and we're already seeing the backlash to this, but I would expect it to be ferocious.
Yeah, the late 70s were a period of retrenchment. And then 1980 saw Ronald Reagan and a conservative agenda that was fiercer, more focused, and more effective than maybe any other conservative agenda in ways that we're still grappling with to this day. I mean, this, the establishment of the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society, any number of right-wing organizations, a master plan to retake the judiciary. I mean, what we saw in the after effect of the Vietnam War was really a brand of conservatism, a new right that the country had never seen before, and it remains to be seen. We're going to take a listen now to police who are speaking after the entry to Hamilton Hall.
Officers to get enough time to get through the barricades.
Did the students resist arrest?
We're not doing an interview.
Did the students resist arrest?
Not doing an interview.
How many students were arrested?
Okay. If you want to learn how to work with me, if I tell you I'm done, I'll give you all the information. But when you try to force it out of me, it doesn't work. All right?
All right, guys, okay. Police obviously not wanting to talk about what's going on at this juncture. Presumably, we will hear more from them or the mayor's office or Columbia University. Once again, just to reset for those of you joining us at the end of this hour, the police, NYPD, have entered Hamilton Hall, a storied building on Columbia's campus where approximately 60 individuals. We're going back to the police. Stick with me. Let's take a listen. Okay. We're obviously dealing with a lot of moving pieces here, but you see a very robust police presence. Police in riot gear use a ladder truck to enter Hamilton Hall, where I think about 60 protesters were inside, had barricaded themselves inside. We have reports that dozens of protesters have been arrested or detained by police. We do not yet know what the charges are. NYPD came to the campus at the request of Columbia University, which requested assistance just after 9 p.m. tonight. We are going to leave it there.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite, too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.